one Melody could explain. Leah was Melody's oldest friend, a nondescript, blurry kind of girl whose most noticeable feature was a persistently runny nose from year-round hay fever. Leah tended to moon a little while following Melody around school, sniffling and sneezing. "How's your lesbian lover?" Bea would ask Melody, referring to Leah. "You guys going steady yet?" "Shut up," Melody would say. She didn't even know at first what lesbian meant. She sneaked into Leonard's study one day to look it up in the dictionary and then had to look up homosexual. And although she knew right away that the word didn't describe her, she knew who it did describe. Jack. She pictured Jack and his friends sitting in the summer sun, lounging by the pool at the club, rubbing baby oil on each other's shoulders. Homosexuals, she thought, slamming the book closed. Melody had led everyone to the kitchen at the back of the first floor. There were no streamers, no balloons, no festive paper plates and matching cups, or shiny cardboard letters spelling out "Happy Birthday" strung above the breakfast nook. But there was a cake box. Melody was hugely relieved to see that there would, at the very least, be cake. "Where's the party?" Kate said, staring at the kitchen sink full of dirty dishes and the table scattered with catalogs and empty grocery bags. "The party is wherever you make it, ladies." Francie had followed the girls to the kitchen to refill her glass, the martini shaker glistening on the butter and crumb-streaked counter. "Party is an attitude, not a destination." The girls looked at her, confused. Even though it was February, Francie marched the girls outside to the lawn beyond the patio, which was devoid of snow but still frozen and bare, and led an anemic game of pin the tail on the donkey. "For God's sake," Francie yelled, standing on the patio in a fur coat, smoking, as the girls walked gingerly forward, mittened hands stretched out in front of them. "How hard can it be to locate an enormous tree trunk?" The pin-the-tail game was old, had been sitting in the storage area under the stairs for years. Melody frantically tried to remember what else was housed in that space, overloaded with broken toys and old board games. How could she fake a party for 2 whole hours? "I think you girls have the hang of it," Francie said after bringing them back inside and handing Leah a keychain with a tiny dangling Rubik's Cube from the junk drawer as a prize for pinning her tail closest to the donkey's ass. "I'll check back with you in a little bit." Melody started sifting through the boxes under the stairs, wondering if she could salvage enough Monopoly money to keep a game going. "I have Twister," she said to her friends. "The spinner is broken, but we can close our eyes and point to a color and play that way. It works just as well." "Maybe I should just call my mom," Beth said. All the girls were still wearing their coats. "I'm thirsty," said Leah. "We could have cake," Kate suggested. The other two girls nodded eagerly. Melody knew that cake was the last thing to happen at a birthday party. After all the games and snacks, the birthday cake was cut, and everyone grabbed their gift bag and went home. Melody did not want to cut the cake. As she stood there with the broken Twister spinner in her hand, trying not to surrender to the tears that had been threatening to spill forth with humiliating force since her mother had greeted them, the front door opened. Leo. Leo had taken pity on Melody that day. He made huge bowls of buttered popcorn for the girls. He went up to his room and brought back a deck of cards and taught them how to play blackjack with pennies. He played the dealer. He brought down the vinyl records he kept under lock and key in his room and let them dance and lip-sync behind his air guitar version of Start Me Up. Just when things were looking up, Francie reappeared, ushering the girls, sweaty and breathless and all a little in love with Leo, into the living room for cake, a cake she'd clearly forgotten to order in advance. "Congratulations, Betty," the cake said, with a little frosting stork underneath, carrying a folded diaper in its beak. "Who's Betty?" Beth asked. "That's another family joke," Melody said, enjoying the versatility of this new excuse, tucking it away for future use. The cake tasted delicious, though, and the girls all took huge pieces and moved to the sofa, where Francie made them sit and listen to her play Harold Arlen songs on the piano. At first it was fun, and watching her mother's fingers almost dance above the keyboard, Melody thought that if the party ended right then, right after the rousing version of If I Only Had a Brain, everything would be fine. The party would be dubbed a success the next day at school, her reputation saved. But then Francie started singing Over the Rainbow, and only a few verses in she started to weep. "Mom," Melody said weakly. "It's just so, so sad," Francie said. She turned to them. "The studios killed Judy Garland. They killed her. That voice, and what a tragedy. They made her, and then they killed her." The girls were sitting quietly, nervously giggling. "Uppers to work all day, downers to sleep at night. She was just a kid." Francie stood now, facing them, her robe gaping a little in front. "I wanted to be an actress. I could have gone to Hollywood."
"You could have been a real contender, Fran," Leo said, leaning against the door jamb, amused.
"Why didn't you?" Beth said, brightening a little. She wanted to go to Hollywood, talked about it all the time. Her parents had taken her on a family trip to Universal Studios the previous summer, and she'd loved every minute of it. Talked about the studio tour like she'd flown to Los Angeles for a screen test.
"My father wouldn't let me."
Francie sat on a large, enormous club chair across from the girls. "He thought it was unseemly. He insisted I go to college, stay home. Then I met Leonard and got knocked up, and that was that."
"Mom!"
Francie scowled at Melody and waved her hand like she was waving away tiny gnats.
"Oh, relax, Emily Post."
She closed her eyes and put her feet up on an ottoman and started to nod off. From across the room, Leo shrugged at Melody. The shrug was more resigned than sympathetic. "See," the shrug said. "Remember this the next time you want to invite friends over." When Beth's mother arrived to take the girls home, she surveyed the scene. The baby shower cake, Francie lightly snoring in a robe, the empty martini glass on the piano, and quietly closed the pocket doors between the living room and the front hall. As she helped the girls button their coats and locate mittens, Melody heard Beth tell her mother, "She said I was the pretty one. Why did she say Leo was a lesbian?" Melody had been scared to show up at school the next day, worried about what her friends would say about her weepy, inebriated, odd mother. But all they talked about was the extremely cool birthday party where Leo Plum, a high school senior, had sung and danced with them and taught them how to gamble. "Hey, Betty," the three girls would say, with affection, not mockery, when they saw Melody in the hall. She'd never been happier than those weeks and months at the end of sixth grade. So Melody had been stunned and thrilled when Jack and Walker offered to host a 40th birthday dinner in her honor. Every year she told Walt that all she wanted was a quiet birthday celebration at home with her family, and she was always, always disappointed when he believed her. "I really think Leo is going to come through tonight," she said, flipping down the sun visor and applying lipstick in the tiny mirror. "I think he's going to surprise everyone with good news."
"That certainly would be a surprise."
"I don't know why, but something about birthdays brings out the best in Leo."
"Really?" "If you say so."
"I do." Melody turned the radio up and hummed along with a song she sort of knew. Leo's email had been vague, true, but it was also encouraging. She'd nearly memorized the long paragraph. Something about an exciting project for Nathan that was coming together very quickly. How he'd left town to meet with some investors and would be out of touch, but back with a progress report in time for her birthday dinner.
"I'm very optimistic," he'd written.
Walter raised his voice a little to be heard above the radio. "What I really think," he said,
is the sooner everyone lets go of Leo as their personal savior, the better off everyone will be, including you, including us. Melody turned the radio volume higher. She didn't want him to ruin her hopeful mood. He'd never believed in the nest, and sometimes she thought he was almost enjoying being right. She believed Leo was going to come through tonight, on her birthday. She'd spent the entire day as if she were preparing for a date, bought a new dress, on the secret card, that's how sure she felt, got her nails done, had dug out the pretty dangly faux diamond earrings Walt had bought for her after the girls were born. She checked herself in the mirror again. Maybe the earrings were too much. She shouldn't have used so much hair stuff. She started playing with her bangs. Melody always felt wrong around her siblings, just a little off. She could see them assessing her clothing, judging Walt. How dare they? They wouldn't know a kind, good, capable person if, well, if their sister married one. She shook her head. Tonight was going to be different. It was. Walter gripped the steering wheel a little harder, biting back his words, dreading the ride home when Melody would be a basket case. He'd give her a day or two to recover from whatever went down with, without, Leo tonight. And then the house was going back on the market. He felt sorry, thinking about what were surely the difficult weeks ahead. But he was also eager to get the necessary changes underway. They would get through it. Melody would rise to the occasion. She always did. He'd always been able to count on her. Louisa waited impatiently at the front door of the SAT offices on West 68th Street, eyeing the threatening clouds that were moving in swiftly ahead of a cold front, bringing weather that was more typical for this time of year. It was going to rain, and Louisa wanted to get to Jack's house before it started. She knew Nora was upstairs saying goodbye to Simone for the week. She stood in the foyer of the building that smelled like bleach and rancid mop and tried not to think about what her sister was doing with Simone that very minute. Three floors directly above Louisa, Nora was wishing she could skip her mother's birthday dinner and spend the rest of the night in the bathroom stall with Simone, who was kneeling on the closed toilet lid so none of the other girls in the bathroom knew they were both in there. Simone had a finger over Nora's lips, and Nora lifted the hem of Simone's skirt and found skin where she expected to find underwear. "Oh," Nora said, and Simone mouthed, "Shh," as they gripped each other and swayed to a tinny bossa nova beat that rose from someone's open window up through the back alley and into the tiny stall. It was so simple, but ever since Simone's easy incantation, "You don't have to be anyone's mirror," Nora had felt released, giddy. She loved her family, her father, her sister, her mother. They were so dear to her, and she would never hurt them or intentionally disappoint them. But Simone was right. Nora had to stop worrying about what everyone else needed and think about herself. And what she needed was to come clean to Louisa because she hated having a secret from her sister. It made her feel like she was doing something wrong, and she wasn't. When Nora met Louisa at the front door, she'd run so fast down three flights of stairs that she was dizzy, dry-mouthed. When Louisa saw her flushed face, swollen lips, she frowned. They both swallowed hard. "We're going to be late," Louisa said, pushing through the swinging doors and stepping out into the rain. "Mom is going to freak." Walker had canceled his Saturday afternoon clients and left work early to cook. He was standing in his and Jack's tiny but artfully designed kitchen, ebulliently pounding chicken breasts between two slices of parchment paper. He'd planned a spring-themed dinner, and even though it wasn't quite spring, the universe had cooperated. It was a beautiful evening, temperate enough to open the windows in the living room and enjoy the faint, earthy scent of the softening ground. Walker couldn't remember the last time they'd entertained Jack's family. It had been years. Melody's birthday dinner had been Walker's idea. He'd been itching to get them all together in one room and try to make a tiny inroad into facilitating some kind of agreement about the infernal sum of money they still insisted on calling the nest, which drove Walker mad. Aside from being infantile, he couldn't fathom how a group of adults could use that term in apparent earnestness and never even casually contemplate the twisted metaphor of the thing and how it related to their dysfunctional behavior as individuals and a group. Just one of many things about the Plum family he'd stopped trying to understand. But Walker did understand conflict resolution. And as an attorney who had to mediate many a divorce, many a broken business partnership, he also understood how money, and the entitlement that often accompanied just the idea of money, could warp relationships and memories and decisions. He'd seen it happening with Jack and his family for years, and enough was enough. He thought Jack was probably right. Leo probably had money somewhere, but chasing Leo was a loser's game. Leo, Walker thought, was a loser. They all mythologized him like he was some kind of brilliant withholding god who just needed the right sacrifice to let loose his abundant blessings. As far as Walker could tell, Leo was just someone who'd been relatively bold at the right time and had lucked out very young. Speakeasy media was a formula that made him wealthy. He wasn't even rich by New York standards, and what had he done since then? Nothing. Blown his wad. Become a leech. But since Leo's accident, Walker had observed an interesting dynamic. The siblings were communicating again. And although the conversations usually began with Leo and the money, something else had started to happen. They were making casual forays into one another's lives. He'd heard Jack and Melody on the phone countless times talking about things other than Leo, other than the nest. B had always been the most amiable and accessible of the bunch. He thought she would welcome some kind of coming together. If Leo could just agree to something tonight, anything, some kind of payment plan, installments, just throw everyone a bone so they could stop gnawing the worn and brittle cartilage of the nest, maybe they could move on. Try to forge relationships with one another that weren't about that blasted inheritance. Walker excelled at mediation, delivering people from their own self-inflicted misery. Families were the hardest, he knew, but he also knew how to try to bring adults past their own wounds and help them find their way, if not to affection, at least to accommodation. It didn't always happen, but it could. There was no reason the Plums couldn't start to accommodate one another and work towards some semblance of family, no matter how tentative or messy. Walker also suspected that Jack was in some kind of financial pickle. So what else was new? He'd tell Walker in his own time and they'd figure it out. Tonight's plan, bring them together over food. Stay focused on Melody's birthday at first. A bit of bubbly, a gorgeous chicken scallopini, the coconut cake he remembered Melody saying she liked once. Then, a gentle discussion about kindness. Accommodation. A different and sturdier kind of nest. As Jack lit the votives lining the windowsill, which would lend a warm glow to the whole room, softening its ordinary post-war architecture, parquet flooring, and flimsy plasterboard, he was also surreptitiously emailing his contact for selling the Rodin. The initial interest in the sculpture had been impressive, but Jack had quickly narrowed the field to two buyers, and one had dropped out when figures started being discussed. The remaining individual, someone he'd never met but had heard about, was a collector from Saudi Arabia who lived full-time in London and part-time in New York. He was a frequent buyer of black market pieces with questionable or infamous provenance. What any of these guys did with art they essentially had to keep secret from the rest of the world, Jack didn't know. Not his problem or concern. When Jack first offered Tommy O'Toole his assistance getting rid of the Rodin, Tommy was under the mistaken impression that Jack could find a way to return the statue to its original owners. That would be extremely unwise, Jack told him. you will wind up arrested and on the front page of the paper. He explained about the person he had in mind, a foreigner of vague business pursuits. We're going to go in high on the price, but even after negotiating, this will be a lot of money, Jack told Tommy.
I don't care about the money, Tommy said. I just want it to end up in a safe place, taken care of.
Of course, Jack said soothingly. Nobody ever admitted it was about the money. Grandma's engagement ring, Aunt Gertie's emerald bracelet, the Chippendale table that had been passed down for generations, it was never about the money. Except that it was always, completely and totally, about the money. And the money, the vast sum, was causing Jack concern. They were going to have to find a way to handle the amount without attracting the wrong kind of attention. He was going to get Leo alone tonight and ask for specific advice, which would satisfy him on two fronts. How to handle his and Tommy's windfall, and determining exactly how familiar Leo was with concealing funds. Jack could hear Walker in the kitchen whistling off-key along with the classical music station, Schubert something. Walker was always happiest when he was entertaining. Jack sent a little plea out to the universe. If he could sell the statue, pay off the loan, he would be a changed man. He wouldn't even care about the nest. If he could save the summer house, he would forgive Leo about the accident. Tabula rasa, and so on. He would be a better person, a kinder and more responsible person, a person of integrity and honesty. The type of person Walker deserved. B was standing cluelessly in front of the office espresso machine, a ridiculously elaborate Italian contraption that required setting pressure gauges and estimating water flow in relation to espresso grind, and examining steam thermometers clipped to milk pitchers. B was a tea drinker, but every once in a while she wanted, needed coffee. Every time she approached the gleaming machine, she wound up timidly turning a few knobs, peering at its undercarriage, and then just walking downstairs to the corner deli. But today she didn't feel like going back outside. She was in the office on a Saturday trying to catch up, and she was exhausted from a series of insomniac nights and near-constant worry about Leo, who had been completely incommunicado since she delivered her new story to him. She hadn't been able to get back in touch with Stephanie either to ask about the strange email from Leo about being off the grid that sounded like complete Leo bullshit, or to find out if they were going to show up for Melody's birthday dinner as planned. She didn't even know what to hope for. Leo or no Leo? Furious Leo or indifferent Leo? Given his silence, enthusiastic Leo didn't seem remotely possible. If Leo didn't show, all hell was going to break loose. How much did this dumb machine cost, anyway? B asked Paul. Technically, office expenses were her domain, but she barely paid attention. I paid for it, Paul said. It was my gift to the office. Would you like me to make you something? Yes, please. B sat on the couch opposite the coffee machine. It was low to the ground, and the cushions were stiff and covered with a nubby fabric. She was wearing one of her favorite outfits in an attempt to lift her mood. A bright red jumper with knee-high patent leather boots. The back of her legs were exposed, and the sofa was scratchy. Why can't we have a comfy sofa? She said. She knew she sounded like an entitled and petulant teenager, but didn't care. Something you can sink into and maybe read and hang out. Because this is an office, and I want people doing the opposite of getting comfy and hanging out. Paul liked to see everyone sitting upright at their desks, good posture, intently looking at computers and pecking away at their keyboards in the center of their otherwise orderly desks. She checked the email on her phone again as the espresso machine started to thump and hiss like a steam engine. If Leo was truly gone, Stephanie either had helped him and was covering it up, or Leo was duping her, too. B moved from the sofa and sat at the office communal table, lowered her head onto her crossed arms, and felt the cool of the wood against her cheek. She felt like crying. She felt like screaming. She just wanted to be able to hear Leo's voice and try to figure out what was really going on. She wanted to know what Leo thought about the story. She wanted her lucky leather bag back. Paul would credit his nearly perfect cappuccino. The foam could have been a little brighter, but the richness of the coffee itself was superb, for working its magic on Bea, loosening her tongue, as he'd been patiently waiting for her to do. She'd taken two long sips and smiled, feebly but genuinely, and said, "This is exactly what I needed." He asked if something was wrong, and it all came out in one breathless stream. She thought Leo was on a bender, or that he'd skipped town. She told him about the accident, about the night in the hospital, and how she'd become complicit in silencing the poor girl who had gone to work one night and ended up minus a foot. She told him about her story and how she'd given it to Leo, and then he had essentially vanished. She told him about the Tuck nightmares. She finished pale and depleted. The quick pulse at the corner of her eye was beating as if there were tiny wings trapped beneath the skin. Paul watched her as she spoke, enjoying, perhaps more than he should have, the slow realization that he had the thing she was looking for. The natty leather folder had been sitting in his office for days, ever since he'd seen Leo saunter away from the waterfront bench with some woman who wasn't Stephanie. He assumed the leather bag belonged to one of them and had put it in his office for safekeeping. He'd left a message for Leo saying he had it. But Bea's recent report explained why Leo wasn't responding to or maybe even getting his messages. Paul would be lying if he said that he didn't estimate, as Bea was talking, how the depth of her relief and gratitude toward him would increase in direct proportion to her visible distress. He could have stopped her, but he let her go. He wasn't even listening to what she said as much as watching her lips move, eyeing the pink flush that crept out the top of her white blouse and worked its way up her neck, watching her furiously fight off tears and try to steady her chin. "What do you think?" she finally said. He realized she had stopped talking and was staring at him, staring at her. "Think?" he managed. "Where do you think he is? What's he doing?" "I don't know where Leo is or what he's doing," Paul said, walking over to his office and coming back with Bea's satchel. "But is this what you're talking about?" He handed it to her and she gasped. "Oh my God," she said, "how do you have this? Did Leo leave this for you?" Had Leo left it for him? "Maybe," Paul said to Bea. Bea was loosening the straps and she pulled out the stack of pages. "They're marked up," she said. "He marked them up." "Leo?" "Yes, this is Leo's writing." Quickly flipping through, she saw scribbling on almost every page in the blue pencil Leo favored, and in his tiny crimped hand, and in their shared and peculiar vernacular, "use, use with caution, do not use." "He read it," she said, not really believing it yet. The pages in her hands, marked with Leo's edits, had to be his way of giving her, if not approval, permission. Because she knew Leo. If he wanted the story to go away, he never would have taken the time to sit and make it better. He would have burned the pages in Stephanie's hearth. He would have deposited the entire bundle into a trash can on the street. He would have dumped the whole thing into the river. If she knew anything, she knew that. But he hadn't. She looked for a longer note on the last page that might offer some kind of explanation, a clearer benediction. But there wasn't one. She flipped back to the beginning. "What?" Paul said, seeing the look on her face, the wonder and relief. It was right there, right on the first page where Leo had crossed out the name she'd chosen for her character, Marcus, and in its place wrote, "Archie," and in the left-hand margin, underlined twice, "Use." Chapter 32. Nora and Louisa were not used to being the center of attention at a family gathering, and they liked it. When they arrived at Jack and Walker's place, their parents and Bea were already there. As they entered the living room, folding their rickety black street umbrellas, all motion and conversation stopped. The girls, at 16, were mesmerizing to the assembled crowd in a way they hadn't been when they were shy little girls who buried their faces in their father's meaty thigh at the occasional family event. Louisa was the spitting image of Melody as a teenager, so much so that Jack was staring at her uneasily, atavistically braced for the familiar visage from the past to crumple and weep over some imagined slight. Instead, Louisa's version of Melody's face smiled at him, curious and warm and sweet. He felt like running his hand over her hair to feel the shape of her skull. Unnerved, he squeezed her upper arm a little too hard and she winced. B hugged both girls tightly and then held them at arm's length, exclaiming over their hair, their height, their identical smattering of freckles on unidentical faces. "You are such beauties," she kept saying, pulling them close to her and kissing them on both cheeks, making them both think of a word they'd never had occasion to use before. Continental. "How have you grown so much since last summer? You're young women." Nora and Louisa beamed with pleasure. Walker filled everyone's glasses with champagne and offered Nora and Louisa flutes of lemonade. His spirits were high, and so was the color in his cheeks. Jack watched him appraising the room and the table, eyes darting, making sure everything was perfectly in its place before bustling back to the kitchen. Nora and Louisa were fascinated by everything, the apartment, the table, their mother's unlikely flirtatious demeanor. "Appetizers? Plural? More than one?" Melody was nearly giddy. Their Uncle Jack, who was a more petite elfin version of their Uncle Leo, their high-spirited Aunt Beatrice, who they both reluctantly realized was a slightly prettier version of their mother. They both instinctively gravitated toward Walker, who was wearing a chef's apron over his gently protruding middle. The only unsurprising presence in the room was their father, who sat at the table, reassuring and solid, tearing into a piece of bread, sniffing one of the runny cheeses and winking at his girls as if to say, "This is something else, isn't it?" Walker beckoned the girls into the kitchen, and they eagerly followed him. He topped off their flutes of lemonade with a generous glug of champagne. "Don't tell your mother," he said, "and I'm not keeping track of how much is in this bottle." He plunged the champagne into a sweaty copper ice bucket and headed back to the living room. Louisa and Nora drank their cocktails quickly and made new ones, adding just enough lemonade to not have the contents look suspicious. Out in the living room, Walker announced they'd give Stephanie and Leo 10 more minutes and then dinner would be served. Walker had lined the table with platters of bread and cheese, tiny ceramic bowls with olives. He'd scattered lemons and twigs of rosemary down the center. Melody's admiration was worth the extra effort.
"It looks just like Italy," she said to Walker.
"And when have you been to Italy?" Jack asked. Walker threw Jack a look that said don't. Melody was too pleased to even notice.
"Oh, I haven't, but I watch the Travel Channel all the time, right, Walt? Don't I watch the Travel Channel nonstop? They just did a piece on Sorrento, all the lemons, so pretty. Limoncello."
"Don't say another word." Walker ran to the kitchen and returned seconds later waving a bright bottle of unopened limoncello in his hand. "For dessert." Melody actually jumped up and down a little and clapped her hands. Jack reluctantly recognized that this was nice, his family admiring Walker's exquisite taste. Wait until dinner. They were all going to be blown away. On the other side of the river, lightning was illuminating the New Jersey skyline. Everyone moved to the window to watch the storm make its way across the Hudson. Nora slipped away, unnoticed, down the hall. She couldn't have named the impulse that made her want to see Jack and Walker's bedroom. She just wanted to see it. The door was closed, and she gently knocked, even though she knew everyone was still in the living room. She opened the door, crossed the threshold, and quickly closed the door behind her. She felt against the wall for the light switch, flipped the light on. She didn't know what she expected to see, but it wasn't the room she found herself standing in, an entirely ordinary bedroom housing what she assumed was an antique bed and rocker, a long dresser with lots of framed photos on top. The bed looked small to Nora, especially for Walker, who was, well, he was substantial. The bed was neatly made. There were no clothes scattered around like her parents' room. It was just a tidy bedroom. She walked over to the dresser and started looking at the pictures. The biggest one, the one in the center, was of Jack and Walker. She picked it up to take a closer look. They were both wearing tuxedos and boutonnieres and both holding their left hands up to the camera and showing off wedding bands. As she was putting the picture back, the door swung open and Louisa came in. "There you are," she said. "What are you doing?"
"Nothing," Nora said. "Looking."
"Snooping," Louisa said.
"Look," Nora pointed to the photo. "They got married."
Louisa walked over and stared at the photo. "Wow," she said. "I wonder if Mom knows."
"It would kind of suck if she knew and didn't go."
"Maybe she doesn't even know. Maybe she wasn't invited."
"That would kind of suck, too."
"Yeah," Louisa said. She stood and took in the bedroom as Nora had been doing minutes before. "I didn't expect it to look like this," Louisa said.
"What does that mean?" Nora said,
even though she knew exactly what Louisa meant. She'd had the same reaction. She'd expected the room to be more... something.
"I just mean, it's so..."
Louisa was trying not to use the word normal. She knew that wasn't right, but it was all she could think of.
"It's so plain," she finally said.
Nora and Louisa stood quietly. They were both a little lightheaded from the champagne on an empty stomach. Outside the window, a sharp crack of lightning. They jumped. A deep roll of thunder. They looked at each other. The air stormy between them, charged. Louisa sat on the bed. Her head was starting to throb. She suddenly wanted to go home.
"I have to talk to you about something," Nora said.
She hadn't been planning on having this conversation now, but the champagne loosened her tongue.
"I know," Louisa said. "I saw you and Simone at the museum one day."
"You did?" Nora was embarrassed, trying to think of what Louisa might have seen. God, what if she had been at the IMAX?
"Are you..." Louisa said. "Are you..." "I don't know," Nora said.
She sat down on the bed next to Louisa.
"I like Simone. That's all I know. I like her."
"She intimidates me."
"I know she does. She's so sure of herself."
Nora nodded.
"She is. But she's also smart and funny and nice, and I really like her."
The rain was coming down harder. Jack and Walker's bedroom faced an inner courtyard. People coming home from work were running to get inside, holding briefcases and coats over their heads.
"Do you think I'm gay?" Louisa said.
Nora laughed, relieved they were finally talking.
"Please don't laugh at me,"
Louisa said, covering her face with her hands, trying not to cry.
"Do you like boys or girls? You know what you like."
Louisa spoke into her hands.
"Boys."
"Okay.
I don't think I can be a lesbian."
"Okay." Nora was grateful that Louisa wasn't criticizing Simone or freaking out in some other way. Louisa dropped her hand, her face flushed in the same exact way Nora's did, two vivid red patches right in the middle of each cheek.
"Are you mad at me?" Louisa asked.
"Why would I be mad? I thought you'd be mad at me."
"I'm mad you didn't tell me." "I tried. I didn't."
"I know," Louisa said. They sat for a minute, both staring out the window. The thunder and lightning had passed, the clouds were moving swiftly, and the rain was tapering off. It still smelled like spring outside the bedroom window.
"It's a little weird, right? Me being with a girl?"
"No, not that. Well, maybe a little that.
Mostly it's strange not being the same."
"I'm just me," Nora said.
"I'm here. I'm the same."
Now she was afraid she was going to cry. Louisa shook her head.
"I'm not saying it right. It's like We used to want the same things and see the same things, and now we don't, and it feels strange. Lonely, almost. Almost like I'm doing something wrong because I don't want the same thing as you.
Oh, Nora thought. This part is going to be easy.
She knelt on the floor in front of Louisa and took her hands.
It's not your job to be anyone's mirror, she began.
Where had the girls gone? Melody looked everywhere before she thought to check the bedroom. She opened the door slowly and saw them sitting on the bed.
Did you ask Jack if it was okay to be in here?
She stepped inside and, just like Nora and Louisa had, started looking around, interested.
We were just about to come out, Louisa said, blowing her nose and trying to collect herself.
Melody saw that Louisa was crying.
Oh, no!
She rushed over and knelt in front of them.
What happened? Oh, my God, did something happen on the street? Did someone hurt you?
No, Nora said. Nothing's wrong.
I want to know the truth.
Melody grabbed each of their hands and shook them a little.
If someone hurt you, you have to tell me. I don't want you keeping things from me.
Louisa started to laugh.
Mom, God, nobody hurt us. We're completely fine.
We were just talking about school, Nora said.
Melody looked back and forth at both of their faces. Louisa was staring at her lap.
Is she telling the truth?
Melody asked Louisa. Louisa shrugged. Nora looked worried. Melody held Nora's gaze, trying to spot any tiny sign of deception.
What's going on in here? What are you not telling me?
Louisa fiddled with the tissue in her hand. Melody put a finger under Louisa's chin and lifted it until Louisa looked her in the eye.
We're not leaving this bedroom until you two tell me what's going on.
Chapter 33. You're so beautiful, Leo had said to Stephanie the first night they'd slept together in her dingy apartment on the ground floor of an even dingier building. It was late August, and air conditioning was a luxury she couldn't afford. The box fan, which made an aggressive click with every full rotation, whirred and rattled in the bedroom window, muffling the sounds from the street. The teens across the way who hung out on the stoop blaring a car radio and arguing until sunrise. The bleeding taxi horns 3 blocks over where traffic backed up from the entrance ramp to the Manhattan Bridge. But that night, the night Leo told her how fucked up he was, the cacophony that usually made her grind her teeth in frustration had seemed romantic, urban, and wild, the perfect soundtrack for her lust. "You're so beautiful," he'd said to her, as she slowly undressed in front of him and he watched, still and admiring on the edge of her unmade twin bed. His voice held such a rare note of wonderment that her throat tightened. And then he covered his face with his hands.
"Leo,"
she whispered. "I'm so fucked up," he said into his palms.
"Oh, God, not now," Stephanie thought. "Not a precoital unburdening. A completely unnecessary recitation of all the ways he was so fucked up.
Hadn't she seen him in action for years already? Didn't she know his flaws? She looked down at the curve of his back, the thread of his spine. How his dark curls, on the long side then, rested against his almost feminine neck. His skin glowed in the moonlight like the lustrous surface of a pearl. He looked back up at her. "I'm really fucked up, Stephanie." She understood with complete lucidity what he was offering her in that moment. Not a confession or a plea, but a warning. He was offering her an elegant escape. In those days, one of Leo's gifts was an uncanny ability to predict how things would play out. His favorite expression was from a speech he'd heard some king of finance give once. "If you want to predict a person's behavior, identify his or her incentives." Leo wasn't saying, "I'm so fucked up." He was saying, "I'm going to fuck this up." He knew something about his incentives that she didn't. But there he was, shirtless, on her bed. Leo, whom she'd been a little in love with for always, and all she cared about in that moment was the length of his body against hers.
"Everyone's fucked up," she said, even though she didn't believe that for a second. She wasn't. Most people she knew weren't.
But she also knew this. Nothing was a sure thing. Every choice was just an educated guess, or a leap into a mysterious abyss. People might not change, but their incentives could. So the first time she and Leo combusted, she'd practically been poised for the breakup. In some inexplicable way, she'd been looking forward to it and all its attendant drama, because wasn't there something nearly lovely when you were young enough about guts churning and tear ducts being put to glorious overuse? She recognized the undeniable satisfaction of the first emotional fissure because an unraveling was still something grown up and, therefore, life-affirming. "See," the broken heart signaled, "I loved enough to lose. I felt enough to weep." Because when you were young enough, the stakes of love were so very small, nearly insignificant. How tragic could a breakup be when it was a part of the fabric of expectation from the beginning? The hackneyed fights, the late-night phone calls, the indignant recounting for friends over multiple drinks and an earshot of an appropriately flirtatious bartender. It was theater for a certain type of person, a certain well-educated New Yorker. And it was, then, for Stephanie, too. Until it wasn't. Until she stopped being young enough. Until, like an allergic reaction, every time she exposed herself to Leo, the welts rose more rapidly, itched more intensely, and took longer to go away. She didn't remember which time, second, third, she'd caught Leo cheating and kicked him out, and he was apologizing and begging, and she was mustering her reinforcements, whose patience was almost gone, strained to the limit, incredulity replacing empathy. What did you expect? Why would this time be different? And her assistant, Pilar, wrote the Kubler-Ross stages of grief on a cocktail napkin to chart her breakups with Leo. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. "You get exactly 48 hours of each," Pilar said. "It's all you need, believe me." She opened her Filofax. "That puts you smack at acceptance next Thursday at 6 in time for cocktails. See you then."
"Don't act like I'm the most pathetic person on earth," Stephanie had said to Pilar, "because I'm not. Not by a long shot."
"I'm acting like you're the most pathetic version of you. Because you are. Times a million." And that was finally what she had to ask herself. Did loving Leo make her a lesser version of herself? When Leo left her house in Brooklyn, he left almost everything behind, including his cell phone and wallet, which was a nice touch, a convincing feint. When he didn't come home the first night, Stephanie vowed to kick him out the minute he was off his bender and reappeared contrite and exhausted. The second night, she started poking around the house and realized certain things were missing. A small duffel of hers and a few of his nicer clothes, the shoes he'd had custom made in Italy. The shoes were the tip-off. He treated those fucking shoes like they were infants, wrapping them in burgundy felt swaddling clothes. Also gone, a small picture she'd taken of the two of them with her iPhone one night. A picture of her laughing while he was playfully biting her left ear that she'd printed out and tucked into the corner of a mirror above her dresser. The one thing she hoped he left behind, the thing she searched the house from top to bottom looking for, wasn't there. B's leather bag with the new story inside. Later, she would realize it never even occurred to her to look for a note from Leo. That he might leave B's story seemed possible. That he would leave Stephanie an explanation, an admission of wrongdoing in and of itself, did not. And she would be more stung than she'd ever admit to discover he'd taken the time to send his siblings the decoy email, buying himself the space to flee. Tonight was Melody's birthday dinner, and Stephanie had told herself all day she wasn't going. But then finally felt obliged to tell his family in person that Leo was missing. Missing was probably too optimistic a word, she knew. Missing implied something accidental might have happened, that Leo had run up against some trouble, was trying to get home and somehow being prevented. And although those things could have been true, Stephanie knew they weren't. As she headed toward Jack's place, she decided she would be brief. Say what she knew and then quickly leave. She wouldn't stick around for the likely hysteria. Acceptance. She had to be honest with herself. She hadn't told anyone about Leo's disappearance and the pregnancy because she was holding on to a sliver of hope. And hope, when it came to Leo, was a one-way ticket to despair. She would go to the dinner, tell the truth, and unburden herself. Because that's what someone would do who was not Leo, who had moved beyond anger and hope to acceptance. Standing in the rain in front of Jack's apartment building on West Street, she steeled herself and rang his buzzer. Chapter 34. Nora and Louisa were sitting toward the middle of the long table, and Melody was standing over them, livid.
"Tell them," she said, gesturing around the table where everyone was seated. "Tell them what you just told me."
"Jack got married," Nora said.
"Not that," Melody said. "Tell them about seeing Leo."
"You're married?" B said to Jack and Walker. Walker raised his hands in a gesture of surrender and shook his head, absolving himself. He'd wanted to invite them all.
"When did you see Leo?" Jack asked Nora, ignoring B.
"Last October," Nora said.
"Tell them the other part," Melody said.
"He was in Central Park, flat on his back," Louisa said.
"In the park?"
B turned her attention to Louisa now.
"He was on his back in Central Park?"
"Drugs," Melody said, biting off the word.
"He was buying drugs."
"I didn't say that," Louisa said. "I said he could have been buying drugs."
"But you didn't see him with drugs?" Jack asked.
"We just saw him on his back," Nora said. "It was after that snowstorm. It was super icy. I think he just slipped."
"It was the day we all met him at the Oyster Bar," Melody said. "He supposedly came straight from Brooklyn. Remember? He said he was late because of the subway, so why was he up in Central Park?"
The three plums sat, thinking. Why had Leo been in the park?
"Even if he was in the park to buy something," B said, "what does that mean?"
Melody snorted. "Seriously? He'd been out of rehab for all of 3 days."
"Okay," B said. "But what does that have to do with us?" She was already tired of this conversation, tired of talking and thinking about and waiting on Leo, and also feeling secretly relieved and pleased about the stack of pages in her bag, the ones with his notes on them.
"When did you see Leo last?" Jack asked Bea.
Bea cowered a little in her chair. She'd hoped not to have to answer that question tonight.
"I haven't seen him in a few weeks," she said, pouring herself more champagne. "I thought he'd been hanging around your office. That's what Jack told me," Melody said.
"He had been," B said, "but he hasn't been around lately."
"Jack's seen Leo quite a bit," Walker offered amiably, placing a huge platter of chicken in the middle of the table that Melody looked at mournfully. She was losing her appetite.
"Just last week, right?"
"You saw Leo last week?" B said.
Jack didn't know how to respond. Every time he'd met with Tommy or one of the potential buyers for Tommy's statue, he'd lied and told Walker he was meeting with Leo.
I don't know exactly when I saw him last."
Before he could assemble some kind of sentence, the buzzer rang. Three short beats followed by two long, just the way Leo always rang the bell. Jack's shoulders slumped in relief. B stood so quickly she banged into the table and the water glasses rattled. Nora and Louisa straightened and looked at the door expectantly. Walt poured a little more olive oil on his plate for dunking bread.
"Oh, thank God," Melody said as Walker moved to the door, wiping his hands on his apron. "He's here."
Chapter 35.
When Walker opened the door and Stephanie crossed the threshold, the disappointment on everyone's face was nearly comical. Jack began blathering immediately, wanting to know where Leo was and saying something about Melody's daughters running into Leo buying drugs the very first weekend he'd been out of rehab. "Is he in the park now?" Jack said, hands on hips, speaking to her as if Leo were her truant child. "Is he buying cocaine this very minute?"
"Excuse me," she said, "where's the bathroom?"
"Is Leo coming?" Bea asked.
Stephanie covered her mouth with her palm, shook her head, and ran to a small wastebasket in the corner, bent over, and started retching. The room quieted, and everyone reluctantly listened until she was done. She picked up the small container and calmly walked down the hall to the bathroom, rinsed out the basket, washed her hands, and put a small dab of toothpaste on her finger to freshen her mouth, all the while trying to process what Jack had just said. Leo in the park, buying drugs, the weekend of the snowstorm. She walked back into the living room where everyone was quiet and concerned-looking and seated around a long table that looked like something out of a magazine. Walker must have done it.
"The table is pretty," she said to him with a shaky smile.
"Sorry about that spectacle. I usually have time to get to the bathroom." She sat on the edge of a chair and unzipped her purse.
"Are you sick?" Bea said.
"Not exactly."
Stephanie opened a pack of sugarless spearmint gum.
"Happy birthday, Melody."
"Do you know where Leo is?"
Melody asked hopefully.
"Not exactly," Stephanie said.
"That little incident in the corner is because I'm pregnant. Leo's the father. I haven't seen him in 2 weeks." She placed a crumpled plastic gum wrapper on the table next to her and held the pack of gum out to the table. "Anybody want a piece?" The night had devolved from there. Melody hustled her daughters away, but not before Stephanie got the play-by-play of them seeing Leo in the park. It was hard to fathom how he'd been doing anything else but buying drugs, flat out on his back, way uptown where he didn't need to be, where, she remembered, he'd always gone to meet some guy named Rico, Nico, Tico, whatever, that very first weekend. The weekend she'd conceived. The weekend she had opened her door to him and asked him not to do drugs. Stephanie was still sitting at the abandoned table next to Bea, who poured them both champagne.
"No thanks," Stephanie said, pointing to her stomach.
"Really?" Bea said. "A baby?"
"Really," Stephanie said, not even trying to hide her pleasure.
From the kitchen, they could hear Walker's uncharacteristically raised and furious voice. "If you weren't spending that time with Leo, who were you with?"
"What's going on in there?" Stephanie asked.
"I'm not exactly following," Bea said, "but it doesn't sound good.
Something about Jack lying about seeing Leo. Has Jack been out to Brooklyn?" Stephanie thought back to the morning she'd stayed home to do a pregnancy test, and how when she was standing at her upstairs window, stunned, she'd spotted Jack walking down the street. She'd hidden in the back bedroom and ignored the doorbell.
"No," she said. "I haven't seen Jack in years."
More raised voices from the kitchen, a slamming door.
"I guess we should probably leave," Bea said.
"Yeah." Stephanie wrapped the baguette she'd been gnawing on in a napkin and put it in her purse.
"For the subway," she explained, apologetically.
The night all those years ago that Pilar had lectured Stephanie about the stages of grief and written them out on a napkin, she'd sat at the bar after Pilar left, moping. She'd drawn a little sad face on the napkin next to acceptance. The bartender, who'd heard it all and more than once from Stephanie, scratched out the sad face, and in its place he drew a tiny red bird, wings spread, flying over the ocean, surrounded with glowing marks like one of Keith Haring's radiant babies. For a long time she'd kept the napkin in her purse, then in a kitchen drawer. Then it got put away in a box somewhere, and when she'd sealed that box with packaging tape, she thought she was through. Stephanie was thinking about the bird as she disembarked the subway and walked home after the birthday dinner that wasn't. For years, whenever she'd had a pang about Leo, she would imagine the napkin and the little red bird packed away in a box deep in her basement. As she strolled down her street among the stately homes and warmly lighted front windows, she thought of the napkin and the meaning she'd always attached to the image. Leo flying away from her, heading straight out to the ocean, unburdened and free. She thought about how grateful she was for her life, her house, emptier now, but not for long. She thought about the small back room that she'd turn into a nursery, and how it would be summer when the baby was born and her garden would be in bloom. She'd have to replace the tree that had fallen during the storm so the baby could look out and watch the seasons pass. She thought about the napkin again, and realized she'd been telling herself the wrong story all these years. Leo wasn't the red bird. She was. Ecstatically